This is part two of a rain rerun from February 1998. This is the rain report. If you have operated 20, 15, or 10 meters over the years, no doubt you've made contacts with many stations using high-gain antennas. In 1976, Roger Cox, WB0DGF, was hired right out of college by High Gain, specifically to design antennas, and design he did. According to Cox, it was a busy time for High Gain back in 1976.
76, we were doing a lot of CB antennas, but by 77, we were starting on new Long John series, the five-element monobanders. We were just getting started on those when the company filed bankruptcy. And we were also doing the redesigned 400, which they called the 300, HDR-300 rotator. That was sort of in process when the company went bankrupt. 76 and 77 time period, we had a line of radios imported from Japan that were being sold. There was the six-channel handhelds, the 3806, the marine versions, the 3506. I was doing a little bit of work on that, not a whole lot.
This for 2 meters?
Yeah, for 2 meters.
Really? I didn't know you guys put on a 2-meter talkie.
We sure did. It was a big one, six channel.
Well, they were all big in those days.
Yeah. And we also had an HF radio called the 3750 that was manufactured by Matsushita, or Panasonic as the stateside name.
160 through 10?
Yeah, 160 through 10.
Really? I never knew you put on an HF rig. Was it around very long?
Probably for a couple of years. After the company got bought by Telex, they decided not to sell it anymore. See, we were purchasing it and reselling it with the High Gain logo on the front, so it really wasn't manufactured here.
The same way with the HT?
Right.
Oh, that was before the bankruptcy.
Yeah. There was one radio that we were just starting on, and it died sort of on the vine, and that was a remote head 2-meter mobile radio. I don't know if you remember too many of the CB radios back then, but High Gain Corporation had a remote-controlled, with all the control in the microphone, CB radio, probably in 76 or 77. The microphone was interesting. It was like more like a telephone handset, and what we call the princess telephone. It had an LED readout, volume squelch, and channel readout right in the handset. And they had a multi-conductor cable, real fat one, that went back to a radio that you'd mount under the seat or in the trunk or something like that. The 2-meter version that we had introduced in December of 77 was just the modification of the 3806. It was the handheld radio guts mounted in a mobile chassis. I think it had an amplifier. I'm not even sure about that now. But it's just a six-channel crystal-controlled radio.
With a remote head.
With a remote head. Yeah. If you look at the old, I think it's airplane movie. Remember the one with the space shuttle?
Sure.
If you look in the passenger compartment, they had a little wall-mounted handset. I think we had sold the movie sets, some of these same handsets.
What was the model number of the amateur one?
I think it was going to be called a 3820 or something like that. But never saw the light of day.
So at what point then did Telex pick up High Gain and all its product lines?
That was April, I believe, or March or April of 78.
So after Telex then took over High Gain in the spring of 78, what did you come out with then?
Okay, we finished up the Long John series, the monobanders for 10, 15, and 20, 105BA, 155BA, and 205BA. Whenever a major change would occur, it might become a CA. You go from an AA to an AB to an AC, for minor changes, and then major changes that go to the B series, and BA, BB, BC, etc. Right now we're on a CA. I think it stands for computer-aided, and that's what our new monobanders are, or the designs are computer-aided.
I might mention that 105BA was one phenomenal antenna. I had one up here just on a little tripod in my garage in 78 or 79. That 110 was doing well, and I had a TA-36 Mosley tribander, which of course is four working elements on 10, 20 feet higher, and the monobander typically outperformed it by 2S units.
Mm-hmm.
It was just amazing. So, you designed the 105BA and the 155 and the 205BA, you designed all those.
Mm-hmm.
What was different about your design versus other monobanders on the market at the time?
As we designed them for maximum front to back and minimum pattern beam width. Our antennas were primarily tuned first for pattern optimization, which goes along with gain, of course. If you narrow down the beam width, the gain automatically increases. And if you optimize for front to back, well, there is some trade-off between gain and front to back, but if your front to back is 15 dB or better, then that usually signifies you have pretty good gain also. That was done first, and then the tuning of the driven element was done second. And we have a beta match we've been using for years and years. It's just a hairpin match where you put a shunt inductor or a shorted transmission line across the feed.
Why a beta match, not gamma or folded dipole design?
Beta matches were basically easier to get to work, to make work, and easier to analyze. The gamma matches that were available back then did introduce a little imbalance to the system also, where beta matches are a balanced type of match. Also at UHF and VHF frequencies, gamma matches tend to be pretty lossy. That was shown in antenna measuring contests at various VHF and UHF conferences in the 70s and 80s. With HF, it probably doesn't matter too much as far as efficiency goes. It's more of a ease of manufacture and assembly and balance.
So you designed the monobanders, and then where do we go from there?
Okay, after monobanders, I had several other projects. We finished up the 300 rotator, put that back on the market.
In what year?
It was probably 78, 79, something like that. It was one of the first digital readout rotators. Pretty big size control box, but the brake was integral to the gear motor assembly. Actually, you had a brake clutch assembly that was engaged at the motor output shaft. So your increments on where you placed the brake were a lot finer. You could place them anywhere. The brake wedge would lock into place every 5 degrees on the ham 4 and every 6 degrees on the tail twister because of just the physical size and the nature of the wedge.
Is there anything more we need to really cover in the 70s?
Not much. I think we started working, we reintroduced the TH4, sold that under the Heathkit label for a while.
Heathkit?
Yep.
Heathkit. How did that happen?
The sales department made an agreement to a private label one of her products, Heathkit.
What did Heathkit call it, you know?
I think it was called TH4.
And how long did you license that before you took it back?
It was only for a couple of years. That was in the time frame when we were converting hardware from the zinc chromate or zinc metallic iridite over to stainless steel. And it was sort of a painful process. We went to hardened, steel plated, and had a few problems with the bolts breaking and things like that. So we went to a larger bolt, went to a quarter-inch bolt on the same type of U-shaped clamp. Worked okay, but wasn't good enough. We went to a stainless steel clamp with a stainless steel bolt. They worked pretty good, except the bolts were susceptible to galling. You get to a point where they lock up, the thread seize. Stainless threads do that, especially if they're put under a lot of torque. You can eliminate some of the problems with putting a lot of like motor oil or heavy oil onto the threads.
We're reminiscing about the last 20 years of Telex High Gain with one of its senior antenna engineers, Roger Cox, WB0DGF. We'll be right back. This is the Rain Report.
You are listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
So you converted from ZMI over to stainless hardware in, what, the early 80s?
Yeah, early 80s, probably 81. Anyway, we eventually went to a standard all-stainless hose clamp by 82 or 83, somewhere in there. Ease of assembly and cost reasons why we went that direction. Just for the antennas. It's just the element clamps on the antennas.
1982, then High Gain bought out CDE. Did you modify their products at all, or were you happy with how they were designed already?
They sort of evolved over time. Didn't do any modification right off the bat. I don't think there's hardly any modification. Some of the things that we looked at and did some changes on was the brake pullout method on the tail twister, the gear strength on both the tail Tail Twister and the Ham 4, the ring gear that was improved considerably early around 1990. There's still little things. We got rid of the terminal strip, which everyone complained about. Went to a pigtail cable with a couple of different styles of weatherproof connectors. The cheaper one for the Ham 4 and a little bit more expensive, but a little more difficult to install probably for some people on the Tail Twister.
The prices have sure gone up on rotors, haven't they, over the years?
Yeah, that's due to material price and also corporate decisions.
After you guys bought out CTE in 82, was there anything of any major consequence that happened in the remainder of the decade as far as amateur goes?
Well, in 82, we also came out with broadband antennas. That was a time period when a lot of the solid-state rigs were showing up, the TS-120, 130, 140 line, where people were going from tube output to solid-state output on transceivers, and they just wouldn't operate into anything above 2-to-1 VSWR. Came out with the TH-7, Explorer 14, which had less than 2-to-1 across all the bands.
That was a big antenna.
Yeah, the TH-7 was the same boom length as the TH-6, actually.
Which is?
24 feet.
No bigger than my TA-36 then, actually, which is 25 feet.
Yeah. Explorer 14 is a 14-foot boom. Explorer 14 used a new driven element, which is based on open sleeve. That's one of my designs, also, and that's a patented antenna.
What's the advantage of an open sleeve?
Open sleeve gives you double bands or additional bands without any traps.
Oh, so it's a trapless antenna, technically?
Yeah, you can get that over either one very broad band. If you merge the two bands together, it becomes one broad band. Like you could do that on adjacent bands, such as maybe 12 and 10 meters, and it becomes one broad one if they overlap. On this Explorer 14, we turn the sleeve element into 10 meters, and the driven element that the sleeve worked against was 15 and 20. Now, the open sleeve's been around since the 40s and 50s. It just hasn't been used on ham antennas until recently.
Well, you didn't patent the sleeve. You patented for amateur use?
Yeah, it's just an application of the sleeve in an amateur beam.
And therefore, did that change the overall performance of the antenna as far as front-to-back or side-to-side rejection?
Didn't affect those. It mostly affected the VSWR, the bandwidth of the antenna, and the efficiency. The traps that we use on antennas are fairly low loss, but they're not lossless. Depends on the trap, maybe as much as a quarter of a dB on 15-meter traps, and more like the tenth of a dB to maybe 0.15 on the 10-meter traps. So there is a little bit of loss, but the most significant effect of a trap, because of its Q, is a reduction in bandwidth. That's one of the things we were going after is bandwidth back in the early 80s because of the solid-state radios. Yeah, TH-7 actually used a little bit different technique to achieve similar performance, and that was a dual-band-driven element. I think the V-series, the V2, V3, V4s, came out probably at that period of time in 85 or 86.
Were these verticals?
Yeah, these are vertical antennas. V-series are all the same electrical design. It's a dual 5/8, like an extended double zip design, based on the feed point at the center, skeleton conical sleeves on the bottom, two of them for complete decoupling. The theory behind the two sets of sleeves is you place the high impedance or the bottom end of the top sleeve at the same physical location as the low impedance end or the top end of the bottom sleeve, and that forces an impedance mismatch, which prohibits the flow of current past that point, or it severely reduces the flow of current past that point. V2 for 2 meters, V3 for 220, V4 for 440.
You still put those out?
Yeah, still do, and they're still pretty popular.
Even the V3?
Actually, we discontinued the V3 for a while, then reintroduced it. In the last couple of years, we actually came out with the V6, 6-meter version of it. It's a long antenna. It's about 25 feet long, but it performs very nicely.
What about the late 80s?
Working on HF verticals at that time. DX88 was done, I think, sometime in the mid or late 80s. That added work bands. It might have been the early 80s. DX88 was primarily to replace the 18 AVT.
Oh, an AVQ.
An AVT, right, AVQ. 14 AVQ is still around. 18 AVT /WB wideband was replaced by the DX88.
And then?
Oh, we went into computer modeling probably by 90-something, 89 or 90. We started out with using NEC, of course, Numerical Electromagnetic Code. The first versions were out probably in the 82, 83 time frame. But those were mainframe versions we used remotely with a terminal. Pretty hard to access and difficult to use. They run on in a batch mode, so we'd submit the file, come back in an hour, pull it up on a modem. Slow process to design anything. It's a lot faster to do it on the range. And we used those codes to optimize the monobanders. That's when the CAs replaced the BAs in a lot of instances. And a lot of the 17 and 12 meter monoband designs evolved. We didn't come out with separate products. We just integrated those with the 12 you can build from a 15, 17 you can build from a 20 meter Yagi.
Roger Cox, WB0DGF, a Telex high gain senior antenna engineer. Cox did not mention that he also designed the high-gain TH-11, an 11-element beam on a 24-foot boom that covers 20 through 10 meters, including the UART fans. It retails for over $1,000. The preceding is not to be construed as an endorsement, explicit or otherwise. For the RAIN Report, I'm Hap Holly, KC9RP.